Setting up
User, your channel started recording.
Their what I'd call old, I guess, OpenHBSD air projects, a lot of Atlas Bus, Mercury systems, and so able to help some of those, and also quite a lot of interest in some of the antenna work I did some years ago. So a busy week for correspondence. Also been talking to Lawrence regarding Pure Signal and the work they've been doing recently, which is very interesting. So I'm afraid that's all the news from down under. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. And I have also noticed that John Melton is currently very active in making some changes to Lin HPSDR. So kind of excited about that. Seems to be incorporating SOAPy SDR a little better, and there seems to be some MIDI work and some discovery work going on. I'm not quite sure all of what he's up to, but I've been paying attention. So next on the list we have Bill, KD5TFD, and tonight he's TFD1. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, where did TFD1 come from? I don't recall doing that, so I'll have to go fix that, I guess. Yeah, nothing to report here. Still working and not radioing, but that's pretty much it for me.
Well, fine business. And then last on the list, we have Bob, V3JKM, shown as recording and away. And so we're open for general discussion. So, Bill, you have a comment about Hackaday?
Oh, it was just a link on an article on there about potentially seeing Rust in the Linux kernel, which I thought Phil might appreciate.
Yeah, I noticed that. Thanks, Bill. I'm going to follow that link. Very interesting. Yeah, it's certainly something we're going to consider, but I just want to get the product out the door as quickly as I can, and then do a review later on. But yeah, there's some advantages I guess it taught in terms of integrity of the software, but doesn't look like the simplest of programs to learn, I must admit. One other comment, I've been in discussion with Lawrence. He mentioned that they're looking at porting Protocol 1, OpenHBSDR protocol, into Thetis, which I'm sure that would be useful to lots of people.
Oh, yeah. Well, it confuses people that PowerSDR is Protocol 1 and Thetis is Protocol 2. And I don't know, some people seem to still like to use Protocol 1. So I guess there's a reason, although hopefully Protocol 2 works better.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if I finished Protocol 2 for the Atlas bus. I can't remember now. It's been a long while since I looked at it. But certainly Thetis is a very nice very nice user interface and new features in there, so I think it's a good idea. But to make it available in Protocol 1 available in Thetis would be very useful, and also means that there's basically one bit of code to maintain going forward, which is a good idea.
Well, and with John Melton's, his will detect either Protocol 1 or Protocol 2 radios, and now it'll detect the RTL SDRs through the SOAPy SDR interface and Lime SDRs.
Oh, very good. I'm slipping behind, Dave.
Yep. So those are nice features. Keep going, John.
I just remembered I had a question from a couple weeks ago for you, Phil. Did routing support ever get into the FPGA code, or was always only on the current physical subnet?
No, it was only the current physical subnet, though.
Okay, I remembered it right. I wonder if they've added routing onto the Hermes Light variant, because I answered a question over there saying, I don't think that's going to work, but I didn't know the code well enough to be sure, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest.
I don't know if this is due to COVID or what, but we have had a lot of kind of downtime since most of the projects were fairly solid together. And all of a sudden, there seems to be a lot of people getting out their old boards and trying to get them working.
Yeah, I must admit, I've never had so many emails regarding some of the original development we did, Dave.
I've gotten quite a few as well.
You commented about using the magnetometer. I've done a lot of work in magnetometers for use in the mining industry. And what we found was the variation of the Earth's magnetic field during the day. And fortunately, in Perth, we have a government website that publishes the Earth's magnetic field on a 24-hour basis, and you can just go to the website and they graph over 24 hours the variation in the Earth's magnetic field. I can't remember the website, but I'm sure you can Google it. But we found we were doing accurate measurements, that we actually went to the website, pulled down the latest value, which I think was every 15 minutes, and used that as part of our calibration process. I don't know if that's available in the US.
Yes, it is, and we're running one of, so we only have like three of the prototypes. Dave Whitten made them, and one of them currently is a astronomical site in New Jersey, and so they have a very good magnetometer built by Acuna. And so we're comparing against that, and we're trying to figure out the sampling rates and things. We seem to have more jitter than they do, but I think we're sampling at a different rate than the other instrument. So it's been an interesting process to figure out exactly what's going on. We've been doing some experiments where somebody walked up to our sensor with a big magnet to see if, and it does detect that very well.
Yeah, we initially had to do our calibrations in the middle of a field, and which worked okay, but we ended up actually built some Helmholtz coils, and you could as long as you had a stable magnetic environment, you could put the device in the Helmholtz coils, you could null out the Earth and the local magnetic field and then calibrate it. They work very well.
Yeah, we have two of the fellows on the project have those, but they're in their labs at the universities locked up, and neither are sure enough if they can go into the lab during these days or not, so they're kind of, they've been putting it off, so there's a little bit of a delay from that.
Yeah, I know when we were first calibrating our Helmholtz coils, the effect of, we were we had an area in the building where everything was stable, but if someone would use, a large truck going by would affect it, and someone using the forklift down below, that was absolute disaster.
Oh, well, that's good to know. These guys were, in the pictures they were sending, they were mounting the magnetometer on a big boulder. And my father was a geologist, so I said, are you sure that boulder has no magnetic rock in it?
Yeah, I mean, walking up to the device, we're at the stage walking up to the device with, with a belt, a metal belt buckle could be detected. The sensitivity of these devices was amazing.
Well, that is really good. So we're hoping these work. They use the PMI chip, and those are available at a very reasonable price, and they're better than the Hall Effect devices. But we're still learning. There's a fairly good data sheet, but there's still a few pieces that are not explained in the data sheet.
Yeah, I remember we were modeling in three dimensions, and the matrix math involved was what the phrase Bill used to use for these things.
It's one of those exercises in an intellectual exercise.
Character building?
Yes.
Character building. That's it. Character building. Thanks, Bill.
It's all very doable, but it's just, if you don't do it all the time, it takes a while to figure it out.
It's interesting. I learned some three-dimensional modeling, graphics modeling you could do in Excel, which I'd never done before. So it was a that was character building, as you say. But having to do this in eventually, you know, we needed to do this in real time, and ended up with a using I can't remember what the computer graphics library we used was. It was something on an Apple, but it was very good. And once you calibrated this thing, you had a sphere, and as something moved past or something came by, the sphere would distort, and you could detect it easily. But that was fascinating.
Oh, that's a nice to have a real-time feedback. Dave made a little program that stores packets once a second and day-long chunks. Or each file is one day, and that was for the convenience of the people who are going to store it. But we still are working on understanding exactly what the numbers mean and if how they compare to the standards that we're comparing to.
So what is the magnetometer ultimately getting used for?
Well, we're hoping to detect some effects that are in the ionosphere, and so that's one of the sensors that we're using it for. We're also going to be looking at phased signals transmitted in the ionosphere.
This probably wouldn't work well for me.
I do know you have some very big power lines very near your house.
Yeah, I was going to say the 100 plus kVA power lights behind me probably would stress calibration a bit here, or stress hearing.
I think so. The idea is the number of magnetometer sites of scientific grade are relatively fewer than a lot of other sensors. So if this could provide a kind of a lower level but widely distributed sensor that could fill in kind of the space between the higher calibrated sensors or higher quality sensors, it would potentially provide a lot of information.
I see.
The kind of cool part is the local part sits in your ham shack and is connected to a computer that has a GPIO pin set. And the other end of it, which is an identical sensor or a circuit board, but with a sensor on it, can sit, say, 100 feet out in your yard, and all the power and signals go over a Cat 6 cable. Not used as Cat 6, but or not used as the, it just, they run 5 volts and they run the signals over the line.
It's essentially a long range I2C, I guess.
Yes, that is. Interestingly, the magnetometer doesn't like anything greater than 3 volts, but we sent a 5 volts power just to make sure we had above 3.3 volts at the other end.
Oh yeah, that's probably to make up for the voltage drop.
Yep. And it is calibrated before it goes into the other sensor. But and then we put a temp sensor on both ends, so you could look at differences if that was important.